Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about the ancients, mysteries, and these mysteries and how they affect us today. L.A. Marzulli with us. One of his works, The Cosmic Chess Match, is brand new one, On the Trail of the Nephilim. L.A. is back with us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. You know him, L.A. Marzulli, with us, of course, teamed up with a film producer, Richard Shaw, created the incredible Watchers series, and we're talking about his latest works. Of course, he's got the Nephilim trilogy, Politics, Prophecy, The Supernatural, the Alien Interviews, The Cosmic Chess Match, and, of course, On the Trail of the Nephilim. Welcome back, Lynn. How are you?
Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Always a pleasure. What's new with you these days?
Well, continuing the research. Volume 2 will probably come out sometime next year. We sort of scratched the surface when we got to Peru. What we uncovered is sort of like just the tip of the iceberg, as it were. It's just fascinating what's out there, just sort of sitting in some of these out-of-the-way museums that we visited when we were in Peru. But it's incredible stuff, and I'm excited about talking about it.
Tell me a little bit about these ancients, L.A. I mean, how far back are we talking, and what kind of knowledge did they possess?
Well, what's interesting, I think, at least the paradigm that I'm holding to as we speak, that many of these megalithic structures that we see around the globe, some of them what I would consider pre-flood. In other words, what we saw, let's say, in Sacsayhuaman, the Great Pyramid, Ollantaytambo, those type of ruins, Sacsayhuaman had boulders, massive megalithic pieces of stone, some of these weighing 120 tons and more, quarried about 40 to 60 miles away from the site itself at 2,000 feet lower altitude. We're talking 12,000 feet above sea level. And it's one thing to see a picture of it, and On the Trail of a Nephilim, I used like 8.5 by 11 inch oversized book and the reason why we did this four color printing is to really try to show as best as we possibly could, sort of give the reader a real overview, a feeling of what it was like to be there. But a picture just doesn't do it justice. When you're standing next to a megalithic piece of rock weighing over 120 tons, and this thing is
cut big
in like polygonal shapes. And what people don't understand is that, you know, you look at the polygonal shapes, but these cuts go all the way through the stone, George. All the way through the stone.
Amazing.
And then the next stone is placed next to it perfectly. You could do it maybe in modernity, in the present day that we live in. It would cost,
maybe. Right?
But it still doesn't account for transporting the stones and then placing them with absolute precision. We are looking at some technology which has been completely lost to us. Whoever did this were able to do it with ease. It was almost playful. Some of the construction that we saw in Cusco, there was sort of like a playfulness, if I can use that word, in the construction of the wall. But it's the same thing. There's not one stone that's the same. They went out of their way deliberately, whoever the builders were, to create these monuments. So those are what I believe are the pre-flood megalithic remains of some sort of a grid work, way ahead of ourselves here, I suppose, but some sort of a grid work that I believe covered the planet. Then later on, let's say maybe 4,000 years ago, between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago in the Americas, specifically in the Ohio Valley, you get the Great Circle Mound, 1,250 feet. And I've been there several times. I've walked over it, looked over it. The first time I was there, I was just awestruck by what I was looking at. And it begs the question, how does a group of supposed hunter-gatherers get together and move all this dirt in baskets with dog sleds, which some archaeologists believe? However, when you ask Native Americans, and this was done, of course, in the 19th century, who built these, they said there was a race that was here before us, and they often call them the giant race. So it's a real mystery, and you know, other authors have looked into this. Other researchers have looked into it. What sort of blew me away is the way I believe it's all connected. And it goes back to, and the sort of the theory is this, George, that, and it's sort of a biblical one in the sense that when we read this story, which is about 3,500 years old, that when these two guys, one named Joshua, the other name is Caleb, they begin to move into what is known as the Promised Land. but it's also known in archaeological circles as the Levant. And when they get there, they send in these spies, and the spies come back and they go, hey, we can't go in here. The Nephilim are there. Giants were there, the descendants of Anak. And, of course, this causes great consternation. And so the Israelites say, well, we're not going in. We're not going to do this thing. And it takes another 40 years for the Israelites to get the gumption, I should say, to actually go into the land and begin to conquer it. Well, we get this mandate from, and remember, this is all like in the Judeo-Christian scriptures. And so you read this stuff and it's like, whoa. But we get this mandate from supposedly a loving, kind, benevolent, wonderful God to wipe everybody out in the promised land. And the first thing we say from our perspective is, oh, my gosh, that's genocide. And it is. The mandate to go in there and wipe everyone out is that's bizarre. That is genocide. It's like, why is he doing this? Well, it makes no sense until we figure in the Nephilim. The text very clearly says the Nephilim were there. And one, of course, is the Nephilim is the unholy union between fallen angels and the women of earth, creating this hybrid creature known as the Nephilim. So the theory is this. As Joshua and Caleb go in and begin to totally wipe out these tribes, some of them flee northward, some of them go across the Atlantic. And we actually have traces of this, and I believe, as other researchers do, Fritz Zimmerman for one, I think Steve Quayle holds to this position as well,
yes.
That they migrated into the Ohio Valley and settled there. And so what I've come to term as Nephilim architecture is all throughout Ohio and in other places.
You know, L.A., I don't know how we can call it, but they seem to have migrated everywhere. Were they the same group of people?
Well, what's interesting is, when I document some of this, there are about 20 different Nephilim tribes that are specifically called out by name. The Nephilim, obviously, is the one that jumps to the forefront, but the Rephaim, the Zanzumim, the Emans, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, all these, the Gigabites, the Termites. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them that are there. And some of these tribes have different characteristics to them. In other words, one tribe is called the Long Neck. So, it's sort of hard to pin down in the sense that we don't have an exhaustive study of these tribes, but some of the tribes had specific characteristics, for instance, the long necks. Maybe they all weren't giants. And it goes back to what I believe is there's genetic manipulation going on in this area, deliberate genetic manipulation. Someone, and we can get into this later, some agency is messing with the human genome. And we're not sure, at least from this standpoint, you know, what's the end game here? Why are they doing this? But this is where we get into the whole, what we discovered in Peru and Paracas and the skulls that we found there and how they may fit into what I believe were a remnant of a Nephilim tribe. But it's absolutely fascinating to sort of follow this and to see the idea or the possibility that when these tribes migrated, certain tribes had certain characteristics and they show up elsewhere in the world.
Is there a cover-up to hide this?
Well, I would say the short answer to that, George, is absolutely yes. In fact, let me just read you. This is some experts from the book. I had a researcher, and this gentleman went and spent the time in the microfiche, and he sent us literally hundreds, and I mean hundreds of reports taken from newspapers from the mid-19th century into the 20th century, and it was just absolutely incredible. So my editor and I picked 50 of the ones that just blew us away. And then out of the 50, we honed that down to about 25. I'll just read you one real quick.
Sure.
This is September 12th, 1900. Let me get my glasses on so I can read this. North Shore policemen at Chicago dig up remains in the sand. The skeleton of a giant who, when he walked the shores of Lake Michigan, stood 7 feet, 4 inches in moccasin feet was discovered in Rogers Park. That's one. Let's move on. Here's one. In 1887, and it basically talks about further digging brought to light a sword which measured 9 feet in length. Hello. Curiosity incited them to enlarge the hole, and after a little time, they discovered the bones of two enormous feet. Following up belief, they had unexpectedly struck in a few hours' time. They unearthed a well-preserved skeleton of an enormous giant belonging to a species of the human family which probably inhabited this and other parts of the world at the time of which the Bible speaks. They're saying that the giant ship was in his flesh. He must have stood 18 feet. Here's one from 1906. Again, this one is in from the Boston Evening Transcript. And let me see how big this guy is.
So it's everywhere. They're all over.
The bottom line is when it's report after report. Here's one. A doctor who was present stated that the man must have been 11 feet tall. That's from a Daily Public Ledger, September 27th. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And what's interesting, George, is when we begin to follow, okay, well, what's happening to these skeletons? And they're unearthed all throughout the Americas, not only in the Ohio Valley, but everywhere, even out where we are here in Catalina Island, right off the coast here. They were 9, 10, 11-footers, supposedly unearthed in the 20s. And, of course, the collection then was given up, and I've witnessed, actually, I've gone to UCLA, and I was privileged to go into the back room and observe the collection. I couldn't take any photographs, but there was nothing anomalous in there. And, of course, it goes back, well, who had control of the collection that came out of Glidden's Museum in Catalina? And I discovered that the collection was actually in three different pieces or parts. One of them is in England, the other one in France, and, of course, here in UCLA, they've got a large part, and the other part is in Santa Barbara. But if there's anything that would perhaps go up against the Darwinian paradigm, it would have been disposed of long ago. And how do we know this? Because we hear report after report of the Smithsonian Institute coming in, collecting these giant skeletons, and then they vanish. And we also know that at the turn of the century, teams, were sent out by the Smithsonian Institute to round up the bones, collect these items, and then ship them back to Washington, where the public doesn't see any of this stuff. However, what's interesting is when I was at the Field Museum in Chicago, which has one of the largest displays of Native American artifacts, no human remains, but Native American artifacts, there was this, and this picture is in the book, by the way, which just blew us away. We're standing here looking at this glass case, and there's a very large, very large spear point, well over a foot long. And, of course, we photographed it. And the caption is, this was ceremonial. Well, it may be ceremonial. George, maybe the chief has a larger spearhead to show his position in the tribe, that type of thing. But the question I asked and actually wrote in, and, of course, I got the typical runaround answer, where was the spearhead found and who was it next to? And we demonstrate this idea in the book, because what we discovered is that there, as the settlers pushed westward and started to go into these mounds and do very primitive archaeological digs, they would find skeletons between 9 and 11 feet, sometimes just up shy of 12 feet. They'd find these skeletons, and in these mounds, next to the skeletons were, of course, weapons which would fit a 9 or a 10-footer. Not the normal small spearhead, but a very large spearhead. We also have a shot of a 26.5-pound axe head that was also uncovered. So, in my opinion, that 1-footer or that very large spearhead that's sitting in the museum may not be a ceremonial spearhead. In fact, it may actually be utilitarian to the person or the hybrid, if I can use that word, who is actually wielding that spear. So it's very interesting how all this is literally micromanaged. I mean, it is micromanaged. When we went to Peru, we saw the same sort of Darwinian paradigm being foisted. It's the whole thing where the little chimpanzee suddenly begins to walk upright, and pretty soon it's a full-grown man. And no one knows how that happens, but it's there, and now we're supposed to believe that.
Well, are you saying, though, Lynn, that the cover-up is based on their intention to hide intelligent design?
Exactly. Anything, any other paradigm, George, that goes against the Darwinian paradigm is immediately dismissed. Ben Stein's movie Expelled delves into this, where he talks about tenured professors losing their professorship, basically getting canned, getting fired, because they just hinted in a classroom situation the idea of intelligent design. the discoverers of DNA, Watson and Crick. Crick was a vexed man. Much, and of course, a discovery like DNA is much like Columbus discovering America. I mean, the thing's been there forever. And when Crick saw the complexity of the deoxyribonucleic double helix spiral of life DNA strand, he was taken aback by it. And there's a quote basically where he says, you know, you could take all the time in the universe, billions and billions of years, and all the, you know, the idea of some sort of some sort of cosmic soup or whatever, and it's just, this thing just is not going to happen by chance. He knew that there was some, that it had to have some sort of designer behind it. And of course, this gets into where we are in modernity with the idea of there's basically two paradigms we can take. And when Ben Stein sits down with Richard Dawkins, one of the premier evolutionists of the 20th and 21st century, and poses a simple question, where did the first self-replicating molecule come from? And Dawkins has no answer. And he finally comes up with the idea that, well, maybe millions of years ago in a galaxy far, far away, a race of extraterrestrials who themselves had to have, risen to some sort of a high standard of evolution by evolutionary means would have created us and then seeded us through the universe. Of course, that's panspermia. So what he's pointing to is ET, but it's circular reasoning because, well, how did that civilization spring into existence? And how were they created, or how did they evolve? So the bottom line is no one really knows, if we're intellectually honest, where we are or how we got here. So the mythos that Dawkins presents us as somehow a highly intelligent, evolved race of extraterrestrials created us and seeded us through here, through the universe, and we wound up on this little rock called Earth, and here we are, we just sort of evolved. That's one paradigm. Of course, the other paradigm of worldview is that, wait a minute, there is a creator somewhere, in some place, that somehow created this extremely complex set of coding, which is in our DNA. I mean, when we think about it, why is it that our arm stops growing? How does the eye work? How does the reproduction system just sort of evolve? And it's the whole chicken and the egg thing. If there's no reproductive system that's evolved, you can't create and reproduce and perpetuate the species. And what we see is that the DNA, and this is why I look at evolution and I just kind of shrug my shoulders and go, this just can't work, because hummingbirds in the present day create hummingbirds. They don't create humpback whales. There's never a mistake. Every time a hummingbird lays an egg, guess what you get? You get a hummingbird. A penguin doesn't pop out, or a leopard pop out of that nest. It's a hummingbird. And we see this all throughout the animal plant kingdom. Now, if we go in and we mess with the genome, that's a whole different story. We can create hybrids and cows with human blood, or, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. But for the most part, all across the board, everything reproduces according to its kind because of the genetic coding which is there. And what's really interesting, you can't cross species. You can't cross a hummingbird with a tortoise and get some sort of a flying turtle. It's not going to happen unless, of course, you mess with it in the lab.
But why not admit that Genesis could be real, or at least most of it, and get on? Why the suppression?
Well, this gets into a whole cosmic conspiracy idea. And I've talked about this in other works, the idea of a coming great deception. We are primed, Exo Vaticana, Tom Horn and Chris Putman's new work and others are talking about the idea that E.T., when he reveals himself, and several weeks ago, of course, in Washington, D.C., Dr. Roger Lehr, our friend and colleague who's been in all the Watcher series, was there and gave a presentation. I've looked at a lot of the clips, and it's just amazing how everyone is calling for disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. And at some point, disclosure will happen. And, of course, this sets up what I call the coming great deception. Jacques Vallée called these entities messengers of deception. I don't see anything benevolent about them. In fact,
nor do I. Hold on, Lynn. We're going to be back with you. L.A. Marzulli with us. We're talking about his latest work, of course, on the trail of the Nephilim. Well, have you watched our television show yet? You can, 10 days free. It's called Beyond Belief. Take advantage of that and look at all the other videos. It's free for 10 days. Just go ahead and take advantage of the trial. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts at the top, and the TV icon opens up. They're able to take you right now. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. L.A. Barzulli with us as we talk about on the trail of the Nephilim. L.A., you know, it does fascinate you. So are we saying that the Nephilim are ETs, or are they something spiritual?
Well, in my opinion, again, it goes back to what the text says, and it basically tells us that fallen beings, the word is angel, which means angelos, which basically translates messenger. And when I say that word, so many people have these preconceived notions of what these guys do, and we need to dispel that. Let me just say one thing about one of the stories that talks about the good guys. When the good guys show up, you still do a face plant. You're totally short-circuited. A good angel, let's say, appears in front of you or me. And according to the text, when this happens, you just short-circuit. You literally do a face plant. You just collapse onto the ground. And the angel comes over and goes, hey, it's okay. I'm sort of paraphrasing here. Get up. It's all right. Sorry about that. And it's like, whoa, didn't really mean to do that. But they are incredibly powerful beings. One example is this guy, Peter's in a jail cell, all right, and he's chained to a wall. It's about 2,000 years ago. The guy's chained to a wall, and all of a sudden, there's other people in the jail cell with him. There's a cell. The cell is locked up. There's Roman guards all over the place. And Roman guards know that if you fall asleep on the job, you get killed the next day. You fall on your sword. So Peter's in the jail cell. All of a sudden, this angel, this messenger, appears out of nowhere. He just comes through the wall. Peter's there. He thinks like he's in a dream. His mind is sort of foggy. He's not sure he's awake or asleep. And he realizes that all of a sudden the chains just have fallen off of him. Well, that's bizarre. So whatever this being is, he somehow can manipulate matter and space in ways that we don't understand. He's working in another type of physics that we don't understand at all because Peter's chains just popped off of him. Peter gets up, and the angel says, get your things, let's go. Well, the jail cell opens by itself. The door, the lock just springs. Peter walks out. Everybody's been switched off. All the guards are switched off. Everybody's asleep. And Peter can't believe what he's seeing. They go out to the courtyard again. No one's there to halt them. The prison gates, these huge, you know, metal structures open up by themselves. That's magic. And off Peter goes. And as they go down the road a ways, the angel just disappears. Well, if we're to believe that, that's really bizarre. And that's a good guy. What's interesting about this, George, is it ties in my opinion, to what we see in the abduction phenomena today. It's very similar. People are switched off. We see people floated through windows, through doors, through walls. That can't happen in the physics that we know, and yet it happens. And this is why I believe in the text when it talks about the fallen guys, the bad guys, the black hats, as it were, that are coming down to Earth, and they're messing with the gene pool. This happens thousands of years ago. We get it not only in the Judeo-Christian ancient biblical text, but we find it in the Enochian text, which were, of course, found in the Dead Sea Scrolls in the Book of Enoch, which is probably the oldest piece of scripture we've got in the Western Hemisphere. And that tells us very specifically that these fallen beings came, 200 of them, descended in the days of Jared, and they began to do the unthinkable. They had sex with the women, and the progeny of this unholy union, if I can call it that, were, of course, the Nephilim. And the Nephilim looked like men, but they were giants, and they also had superhuman power, possibly telepathy, which, again, we hear some of this tied back into Native American legend, mythos. I interviewed a man by the name of Robert Mirabal, just incredible guy. He's actually won a Grammy for some of the works that he's done. And I saw this. Someone sent me the link, and I looked at this link on YouTube, and I about fell out of my chair. And Robert Mirabal is quoting literally Genesis 6 almost verbatim. He talks about, you know, many, many generations, thousands of years ago, whatever. The sky god saw the son and daughters of men and came to Earth and had sex with them, and guess what happened? Giants were in the land. And the piece is called Stiltwalker. You can Google that after the show. It's just amazing. And as the Native Americans are all dressed up in full Native American regalia, the whole deal, the buffalo skull, and there's this musicians are behind them, and it's an outdoor theater, and the lighting's just incredible. It's really well done. And they're all sort of kneeling in tableau. And the music is behind them, and Robert Mirabal is narrating all this. And all of a sudden, this guy on stilts, who's over 10 feet tall, comes walking in. Well, when I saw that, I was really taken aback, and I called Robert, and I asked him, I said, where did you get this from? Who told you the story? He told me that his grandfather originally told him the story, and his grandfather's father or grandfather told him. This mythos, if you want to call it that, goes back hundreds, maybe 1,000 years, maybe longer than that. And what's amazing is it's not exactly like what we see in the Genesis 6 account, but it's very, very similar to the Genesis 6 account. And he told me that according to his legends, that these giants could read your mind and tell the future. So they had superhuman capabilities.
Isn't that amazing? It just really is mind-boggling.
It's completely mind-boggling.
L.A., I'm going to come back to the Genesis portion of your work, but let's talk about this Peruvian elongated skulls. What's going on there, and what are these? They were in a museum or what?
Well, there's a man by the name of Brian Forrester. He's a guide. He's a tour guide down there, but he's also a researcher. He's a lot more than a tour guide. That's really an understatement of what he is. And Brian, I actually dedicated On the Trail of the Nephilim to Brian because the guy's just amazing. And again, I saw several YouTube. Someone had sent me, and Brian's holding the skull, and I contacted him and said, we got to come down here. So we took a team of people. My partner and I, Richard Shaw, went down, and this became Watcher 6. It's not really a travelogue, but because what we found there was just mind-blowing. But it's our journey to Peru and why we went there. We also took down an archaeologist, Judd Burton, who's also an author and talks about the giants of the Nephilim in his book, Conversation with the Giants. We took Ron Moorhead, who was a Bigfoot researcher. That was just fascinating. And Joe Taylor, who's the curator of the Mount Blanco Museum, who went down there specifically to cast one of the skulls, and I actually have the cast in my hands as I'm speaking to you, and that cast, people can see it. It's up on your website. Thank you, Lex, for putting that up. And I think it's the third picture down where you see Joe holding it in the palm of his hand. And we went down there, and it was almost too good to believe. The first night we were in Lima, and we were supposed to go. My first question to Brian was, I want to go see the golden mummies. I had read about them, heard about them. He looked at me and said, well, L.A., I'm sorry, they were taken down about a year and a half ago, and the public can't see them. Now, these golden mummies, George, were over 9 feet tall. 9 feet tall. And you can't see them anymore. They're gone. The window, what I'm trying to get at is the window is closing. We went to a museum, the National Museum in Lima. We walk in, there's a whole wing, there's a whole room that they have, a very large room, like 40 by 30, a very, very large room with all the, and this room is supposedly housing all these different elongated skulls from Paracas and other places. We get there, that's gone, completely gone. It's boarded up, new drywall, the wall's painted, and, well, it's under construction. It had been under construction apparently for months. Well, when is it going to open? Well, we're really not sure yet. But what are you going to have in there? Well, that's classified information, blah, blah, blah. And the bottom line was there's nothing to see. There's absolutely nothing to see. So the stuff that we went down there to see in Lima was no longer there. And this is why Paracas Museum of Senior Juan Navarro is just so incredible, because we went there, and which is about a three-hour drive outside of Lima, and Paracas is on the coast of Peru. It's sort of like Malibu, California was maybe 200 years ago, just one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. And it gets about a quarter of an inch of rain a year, very, very dry. And there's a place called the Changos Necropolis, which is this very large, it was the bleakest place I'd ever been to, George. It looked like the Sahara Desert, miles and miles and miles of just sand. It's all you see, and roll, sort of rolling dunes that right. go way out in the distance. And this Changos Necropolis, this graveyard, is where these skulls are coming from. So when we got to Paracas, we go into the museum, and here's this case of 40 skulls. And Brian Forrester's with us, and he goes, which one do you want to see? And he opens up the case, and he just hands us one. I'm sitting there with my jaw on the ground. You've got to be kidding me. I mean, you can't do anything like this at all, even remotely, in the United States. And, of course, having Judd Burton there and Joe, we weighed the skulls, we measured them, we looked at them. Judd Burton is working on a chart with the skulls, and some of them were cradle-head boarded. We get that. That means that as an infant, the skull is bound.
Elongated.
Right. Yeah, elongated shapes. But you can tell the difference between the ones that are cradle-head boarding and the ones that are not. What we saw, and I'm holding the cast in my hand as we speak, the human skull has four plates which hold it together. The frontal plate, the two parietal plate, which is on the top of the skull. There's a suture that goes from the frontal plate to the rear, and that creates two parietal plates. And then in the rear, there's an occipital plate, or the plate in the rear. And sutures, they look like stitching, sewing, which is why they call them sutures, because in essence they are. The sutures are suture patterns for a normal human skull. You would see the frontal plate connected to the parietal plate, and from the frontal plate, there'd be a suture called the parietal suture. It's all very technical, but it would go right on the top of the head and go clear back to the rear. Well, guess what, George? These skulls only have one parietal, and that's completely anomalous. Plus, if you take your head and your hand and put it on your forehead, at the top of your forehead where it begins to go back to the back of your skull, it's all flat there. These skulls have this very large, pronounced ridge, which runs on the top of the frontal plate. Added to that, some of the larger ones in the rear have this sort of heart-shaped dome in the rear of the skull. You can't achieve this through cradle headboarding. You can't wind up with only one parietal plate. The suture patterns are wrong. The zygomatic arch, the bones underneath the eyes, which connect, sort of hold the eyes in their socket, right behind the eye and going back into the ear, zygomatic arch, it's called, very pronounced. The lower, the mandible, the jaw, very robust, very pronounced. And I know one of those skulls is on the Coast website. Judge for yourself what we're looking at. It's, in my opinion, it's not human, and I believe we are looking at some sort of genetic manipulation that happened. And this is what's really interesting. The Paracas culture appears on the shores of Peru, absolutely out of nowhere. They just show up about 3,000 to 3,500 years ago, right in the timeline of what we call the diaspora, where Joshua and Caleb, as I said in the first half hour, coming into the what's known as the Promised Land or the Levant, and these tribes, these Nephilim tribes, some of them are going north, some of them are fleeing for their lives across the Atlantic Ocean. Guess what? I believe that what we found in Paracas, Peru, are the remains of the Nephilim. We've done some testing on them, not exhaustive testing. Obviously, we're trying to get DNA testing.
Yes.
But the testing we did with the hair samples was absolutely mind-blowing. Absolutely.
What did that show?
Well, we took some of this auburn reddish hair from one of the skulls. And that skull, again, is you can see it on your website, which is so cool about Lex. Thank you, Lex, for doing this. So we were able to take some of the hair back, and there's a machine, a scientific machine, it's called Raman spectroscopy. And what this basically does is it takes whatever you're examining, it breaks it down in the molecular structure. So it'll look at the molecular structure of the item and plot it on a graph. And so we had four samples that we put in this Raman spectroscopy. And we ran through Raman spectroscopy. The first was a human hair, a normal human hair. And without seeing the graph, I'll make it as clear as I possibly can. If you take a letter O and you cut it in half, that's sort of like the graph for the human hair. It just kind of comes in the middle. It kind of nice little arc and then falls down. Well, the dyed hair, we took the second hair, a human hair, but it was dyed. It started off mid-graph, but went spike, like straight up, just kind of like in an arc. A real quick arc that went up and off the charts on the top. So there's a huge disparity between a normal human hair and a human hair which has been dyed. Well, then we took the red hair from Paracas, Peru, from this skull, which is at least 2,000 years old, and I'm being very conservative. It could have been 2,500 or even 3,000 years old. No way to tell, but it was very, very ancient. We took that hair and we put it in, and we checked it and ran it through Raman spectroscopy, and we had a hair from a man, and this is where it goes right off the charts, but I know your audience will totally get it. We had a man who was abducted, and it was a frequent flyer. He'd been abducted many times over the course of his life, and he was forced to have sex with a female hybrid. And upon awakening, there was a blonde hair. And this is not the guy in Australia. That's another case. This guy locally here in California, apparently. And he found the hair on him, and he had the presence of mind to take it and basically put a plastic bag and hold on to it. So we took what we term hybrid, alien hybrid hair, which was blonde, by the way, and we ran it through Raman spectroscopy. So now we've got the red hair and the alien hair. And, George, this is where we're right off the charts. these two hairs tracked beat by beat, every little jot and tittle, every move on the graph. They followed each other all through the graph. We about fell out of our chairs when we saw it. It was absolutely mind-blowing. Nothing at all like the human hair or the dyed human hair. The red hair from the 2,000-year-old Paracas skull and the alien hybrid, every little move, every little nuance tracked. And, of course, one was in modernity, maybe a decade old. The other's 2,000 years old, and yet they track. Now, that's not conclusive proof that the same guys are doing it. But what it does do is it bolsters our theory that who's ever doing this in antiquity is repeating the same type of genetic manipulation in modernity, specifically with this man who was forced to have sex with a female hybrid. It's absolutely incredible.
Now, back to Paracas for a moment. The myth is flying men. And are we talking about machines or what?
No, there are these textiles in Paracas, which are just the closest thing we have to it in our day would be parachute silk. That's how fine these textiles are, which are thousands of years old, which once again begs the question, where did this come from? Who invented this? How do these people know how to do this? Yeah. And we see these extremely intricate designs in these textiles. And one of them, and this is where we get the flying men of Paracas, there's this entity, and he's flying, and he's holding a skull in his hand, George, and he's licking the human skull. And this is one sort of grisly aspect of this we found wherever we went. Going back,
you mean like a cannibal?
Like a cannibal. In other words, there's some sort of ritualistic human blood sacrifice that is happening not only in Paracas, but there's evidence of it happening in Ohio at the Great Circle Mound, because an altar was found there, was excavated, and on that altar were human remains. So we know that human sacrifice took place at these sites. We believe, anyway, that human sacrifice took place. It's not conclusive, but when you look at a drawing of the flying men of Paracas, of this angelic, this whatever it is, this being that's flying in the air, holding a skull and licking it, that's bizarre. That is really bizarre, and that's what we discovered there.
Just incredible how this has been going on. Now, does the skull that you saw, or the skulls, do they look like Lloyd Pye's skull, Star Child?
I'm very familiar with Lloyd Pye's skull. I've seen pictures of it. I followed it. I've actually interviewed his colleague, Amy Vickers, several times and found it to be just incredible. It is completely different than the Star Child skull. But I would say there's absolutely no similarities that I've been able to see between them. These skulls are very elongated skulls. And the chart, what's called the Star Child skull, looks completely different. However, that being said, because of a genetic anomaly or someone, some outside agency is messing with the gene pool. I think we can all agree on that. Something is going on which shouldn't be going on, and yet we've got evidence of it. There was a skeleton that we saw down in Peru called the Waiki skull, and it was an entire skeleton. And, again, very, very anomalous. It was missing two ribs. The fontanelle, which is on the top of the skull, was open. Babies, when a child is born, a baby is born, we can press on top of the skull, we can fill that hole. That's because the plates have not joined together. That's called the fontanelle. When the child is about 2 years old, that little hole is completely closed up because the skull now has closed and the plates have joined together. Well, the Waiki skull is not joined together. The fontanelle is still open, and yet it has molars. Again, it's two ribs short. It's a complete anomaly. The skull is incredibly elongated, and we got to go to this little museum, George, literally in the middle of nowhere, this little town in the mountains of Peru, and we pull up, and the curator was there. We met Senor Ronaldo, and he had a glass.
Hold on for a second, okay. L.A. We'll be back. Hey, Marzulli tonight, as we talk about On the Trail of the Nephilim, fascinating story. So we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with L.A. Marzulli. Lynn, let's let you finish up on that thought of cannibalism and what was going on during that day.
Well, it certainly was weird when we look at the flying man of Paracas licking the skull and tying it into what may or may not have been happening with human sacrifice in the Ohio Valley 3,000 years ago or even earlier than that. There's another mound that overlooks the Circle Mound. It's high up on a hill. It looks over the entire valley of Newark, Ohio. And I was on that mound also and was told that when archaeologists went in and begin to examine the mound, they dug into it. They then found another altar. This is in a high place, and on that altar was once again human remains. So something's happening here, George. We see this all through antiquity where human blood sacrifice is demanded by whatever entity these people are worshiping. And, of course, in my particular worldview, in my particular paradigm, this all goes back to the fallen angelic hosts. These guys are incredibly malevolent, and I believe that there's been a cosmic war. In fact, we've entitled Watcher 6 the Secret Cosmic War. This cosmic war has been going on for millennium, and now it's beginning to spill out in ways that I've never seen it on the planet, talking about the earthquakes and the floods and the weird weather patterns we're getting. Not only that, but the plethora of UFO sightings. I was talking to George Feiler. We actually were interviewing him over the weekend. We were back in New Jersey, which was just a fascinating interview, by the way, with George and also Dr. David Jacobs about the alien abduction phenomena that's been taking place. And George was telling us that he's never seen so many sightings, literally 1,000 last month, 1,000 UFO sightings. And I reminded him that in
Peter Davenport said the same thing, by the way.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he cited Peter Davenport, exactly. 1,000 sightings. I mean, the phenomena is real. It's burgeoning. It's not going away. In my particular worldview, I think this is all connected. It goes back into antiquity. Like Jacques Vallée says, these are messengers of deception, in my opinion. Dr. Jacobs, who doesn't have a Nephilim dog in the hunt at all, he looks at the phenomena, and he's taken aback by what he sees with the so-called breeding program, and he doesn't have a good feeling about it. I mean, he won't say it's malevolent. He won't use that strong of a word.
Pretty close, though.
But it's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah. I want you to paint a picture for us, L.A., on Genesis. If you can explain in your terms what you think happened here a long time ago, where they might have come from, what the mission was, what happened.
Well, and I'm going to catch a lot of flack for this. I don't really hold to the 6,000-year-old universe. The universe is 6,000 years old. It just makes no sense to me. There was some sort of a creation that happened. Who knows how far back in time it goes. It's irrelevant. All I know is that our story sort of picks up well after that. There seems to be this angelic host. There seems to be some sort of a cosmic war that happened. There's definitely a cosmic war that's happening. We may see traces of that, for instance, in the asteroid belt. Might have been a home planet. But something cataclysmic has happened. Of that, there can be no doubt. Mankind comes into the scene very early, 10,000 years ago. I mean, geologically, that's or from looking at the span of the universe, and I realize Darwinists would go, oh, no, it's millions of years. Well, I just don't buy that because history just all of a sudden just kind of we get this eruption about 10,000 years ago where we see mankind begin to do things on the planet and spread out. The millions of years thing just doesn't hold water for me. But at any rate, what we see happening here, and I believe that mankind was created to replace the fallen angelic host. Well, that's my theory, all right? And I know that might sound crazy to some people, but that's what I'm going with. And everything was good. But because of this cosmic war that's going on, the fallen one, the fallen angelic host, gets in there and starts messing around. And what we see is that mankind has a real problem, and they kind of blow it. Whatever the thing is that they do, something happens, and it's no longer the same. Well, we get this first prophecy thousands and thousands of years ago where we hear that someone will come. It's very specific to prophecy. It says someone will come who will crush your head, talking about the serpent. You'll bruise his heel, but you'll crush your head. And so the gauntlet is sort of thrown down, and now the cosmic war has been raging, But now we see that this cosmic war has some real specific instructions or real specific things, events, which are going to happen in the future. And so the fallen one goes, well, this is really easy. All I need to do is pollute the gene pool, and this figure who will crush my head will never come to being. I write about this extensively in the Cosmic Chess Match. It's I do it precept by precept in that book. But we see that this is what he's after. And of course, in that moment of time, the 200 Watcher Angels descend on Mount Hermon, and the unthinkable begins to happen. They literally take wives from the female population. They have sex with them, and the Nephilim are born. The work of the late David Flynn blew the UFO community wide open when he figured out that if you were to take the polar opposite from Mount Hermon, this is the work of David Flynn, just an amazing guy. He passed away in 2012. But if you were to take the polar opposite of where Mount Hermon is in the Middle East and go 180 degrees, because the fallen ones are very big on ley lines and all this. We'll talk about that later maybe, because it goes back into the what we believe the ancient megalithic structures which covered the planet and created some sort of a grid, all right, in the days of Noah. So Flynn postulated and proved that if you go 180 degrees away from Mount Hermon, you wind up in Roswell, New Mexico. And to David Flynn and others, certainly myself and other researchers, that is no accident. Whoever is landing on Mount Hermon is doing the same type of thing in modernity. It's like a signal. It's like a signal. And, of course, Flynn wrote a paper on it, which now has become sort of legendary in both the UFO circles and the circles I travel in. So this all goes back to this great cosmic war. They're messing with the gene pool. Then we get another prophecy, and this will hopefully kind of put the thing to bed. 2,000-year-old prophecy that specifically states, it will be like the days of Noah when I come back. And, of course, this is uttered by Yeshua 2,000 years ago. Most people know him by Jesus. Before you turn the radio off, let me get this in. It's not, we're not talking religion here. We're talking a secret cosmic war, and we've got proof of it. We literally have proof of it. But why does he point back to the days of Noah? Out of all the other days he could talk about or point to, he points back to the days of Noah, which begs the question, what differentiates those days from any other day on the face of the earth? And it's the presence of the B'nai Ha Elohim, which translates as the sons of God, and the fallen angelic host, which then create this hybrid known as the Nephilim. And the days of Noah are far more complex, George, than I ever figured. And going to Peru blew my mind, because we realized, oh my gosh, the days of Noah, yeah, the fallen angels were there, but these ancient megalithic structures also played a part, a great part, in the days of Noah. This whole thing was destroyed. When we were in Ollantaytambo in Peru, and there's a place called the Temple of the Sun. Again, these names are total misnomers. We don't know what this temple was really called. Again, ancient megalithic stones weighing 40, 50, 60 tons, quarried from across the valley, dragged up this mountain, and just getting up there is a chore in itself. Hiking up there, we were just winded, because you're about 10,000 feet above sea level there. It's just incredible. And we get up there, and these megalithic stones, and by the way, there's not a rune or a glyph or an etching. There's nothing. There's no signature. The place itself is a signature. And Brian Forrester pointed out that something cataclysmic happened and blew this thing, took these stones and washed them down to the valley floor below. And of course, immediately one thinks of Noah's flood. It's like, oh my gosh, this thing, whatever's going on here, this grid system, which we found evidence of in Peru, was deliberately destroyed. And I believe it ties back into Noah's flood.
Who recorded this? Because it seems to be so accurate. Who passed on the story?
Well, some of this stuff is word of mouth. The flood legends are in all cultures all over the earth. The Chinese have a flood legend. The Chumash Indians right here out in Los Angeles area, they have a flood legend. It differs from people to people, but it's the same deal. Something cataclysmic happened in the far distant past, and it wiped out these ancient megalithic structures. I also believe that the Great Pyramid in Giza was part of this grid network. It's certainly not a tomb, as Zawi Hawass, with all due respect, and others of his ilk point to and insist that somehow the Egyptians built this thing. These stones, the casing stones, for instance, all had piezoelectric properties. In other words, they were able to conduct electricity. We found the same exact type of structures, not only in South America, but we found in Rockwall, Texas, when we were there filming Watchers, one of our Watchers segments, and we interviewed John Lindsay, a sort of an amateur archaeologist who conducted these archaeological digs at Rockwall, Texas, this huge structure. He found evidence of piezoelectric properties in the stone. In other words, the granite that was used, there's only one other place this granite is found, and that's in the King's Chamber and the Great Pyramid, which is mind-boggling. Again, so this structure, and it's all also, again, on the 33rd parallel, just like the Great Pyramid of Giza. There was a network of ancient megalithic structures which circled the globe at some point. And many of these were completely wiped out, totally destroyed, and it wiped out the grid system. And since we're into this, I guess it may be time to spill the beans with this. My partner and I, Richard Shaw, are walking on the streets of Cusco. We're ruminating about all the things that we've seen, these ancient megalithic structures, these huge, you know, stoneworks that just defy logic and physics as we know them. How the heck do these people do this stuff? All the skeletons that we're seeing, the genetic manipulation. And then it dawned on us when we sat there, George, this has never happened to me with any other human being on the planet. And we looked at each other, we got this sort of cosmic download, and the light bulbs went off, and we're looking at each other at about 10:30 at night on the streets of Cusco February this year. And I just sat there, and I literally had my head in my hands going, I don't believe it, I don't believe it, over and over and over again. And we got back to the hotel rooms, and we go, we can't write this stuff down. This could get us killed. We didn't send emails. We didn't talk to anybody about it. Only after the Watcher 6 came out and the book was published, now we feel free to talk about it. And what we discovered, I'll spill the beans in this segment, might as well because we're already doing it, but what we discovered was, as in the days of Noah, and this is what's chilling about it, George, there was an ancient grid system that covered the planet. We're not sure exactly what the grid system did. Did it control the weather? Was it some sort of communication device? More than likely, yes. The structures that we saw in Cusco, there was this one doorway, George, which looked like something out of Indiana Jones. It had nothing to do with idols or temples or anything. This was some sort of a machine with piezoelectric properties found in the rock, quarried again from miles away, fit without mortar, fit perfectly together by an unknown technology, by a race of whoever built this thing, which no longer exists. And this machine, whatever it was pretty much destroyed, but there's a remnant of it. And we looked at this gateway, and this might sound a little woo-woo, but the night before, I was dreaming, okay? And it was almost like I was being told, look at this, look at this, look at this. And this was sort of the key, which Richard and I sort of, well, for me anyway, it kind of, whoa, something's going on here, which we're not seeing, but now we're seeing it. I kept seeing this horizontal piece of stone with holes in it in this dream. All night long, I kept dreaming that the dream would change, but floating above the dream was this horizontal stone with holes in it. I woke up going, what the heck is that? Well, I find myself at this ruin, ancient megalithic ruin, this doorway, and above the doorway is a lintel, a large rock, exactly like the dream with holes in it. And I just sat there going, I can't believe this. This is exactly what I saw last night. And this is what we realized, that this was not a temple, that this doorway had holes and grooves and slots in it, pictures of it in the book, which maybe played smooth. Was it some sort of tuning device which tuned this large megalithic structure, whatever it was? We're not sure how it worked. No one knows. But it's not a niche to put some golden idol in. That's just nonsense. It's a highly sophisticated machine, we believe, was part of a grid system that it covered the planet, that literally was used to enslave, because I'm going someplace with this, literally used in the days of Noah to enslave humankind, perhaps control the weather, perhaps control human beings' behavior, we're not sure. But fast forward to modernity, and remember the prophecy of 2,000 years ago, it'll be like the days of Noah.
That's right.
The grid is back, George. The grid is back, and it's all over the planet. And I'm talking about the satellites, which are over here, the World Wide Web. Right now, it's all benevolent. But we know from prophecy, And this is what absolutely blew us away, and I've been dying to tell you this. We know from prophecy that at some point this grid system will be used, just like the days of Noah, to enslave the entire human race. How do I know that? Because we know that every person on this planet will not be able to buy, sell, or trade unless they have this mark on them. It's called the mark of the beast. We've all heard about it. But the mark of the beast is actually something a lot more devious than just buy, sell, or trade. You take this mark, and I believe it ties back into what Dr. Roger Lehr has seen and discovered with his work with the so-called alien implants. These are highly sophisticated nanotechnology chips, which are in people, embedded in people against their will. I believe they are changing the host DNA. I believe it ties into ancient prophecies, which talk about the mark of the beast. Guess what? Right now, it's all benevolent. We get that. Although we look at HAARP, HAARP's not so benevolent. Is HAARP causing earthquakes? Is HAARP causing storms like Hurricane Katrina? The same type of grid. It's different. It's not the megalithic structures that we have in antiquity. But the grid is back. And at some point, George, at some point, it will be used, just like it was in antiquity, to enslave the human race. Prophecy tells us that's what it's going to be used for. And Richard and I, when we got this download, we just sat there with literally our jaws on the ground, because it links antiquity with modernity.
Who will kick it into high gear? How's it going to happen?
Good question. I have no answer to that, only to know when this figure comes on the scene, by the way, Chuck Messler's talked about this, and others. Tom Horn certainly has talked about it. Chris Putnam and others. Gus Dizdar, I know he's been on your show fairly recently. We believe that the Antichrist figure will be a hybrid, will actually be a Nephilim. That's what we believe. He'll boast some sort of a Nephilim or an alien connection. That's what we think this figure is going to be. And, of course, when he comes into power, he'll use the technology to enslave the human race. All the scandals that are going on, all the NSA stuff, they're already, you know, just a couple of steps away from that when you really think about it. Monitoring phone calls, monitoring emails, checking. I mean, who are these people, and why are they doing this stuff? And, of course, the scandal is breaking. Well, when the Antichrist comes to power, you won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without this mark. And when you take the mark, it will change your DNA. And in my opinion, George, what's so damning about when you take the mark, because another prophecy is that anyone takes this thing, they wind up in a lake of fire. Whoa, wait a minute, lake of fire, what are you talking about here?
Yeah.
Why are you doing that? Because the DNA structure is changed. At the cellular molecular level, you are no longer human. You become Nephilim. You become the seed of the serpent. You become exactly what the fallen one has been trying to do, and that's to create man in his own image. Again, I'm looking at the skull from Paracas, genetic manipulation that's been happening all throughout history, and we think we put the pieces together with what we discovered in Peru and also what we discovered in the Americas.
So Revelation, in your opinion, is accurate?
It's very accurate. It's literal. It's absolutely literal. There's one scene in the book of Revelation where there's a summoning. Russ Dizdar talks about this. There's a summoning where these spirits, this is all very supernatural stuff, and I believe it's literal. These spirits that kind of look like frogs, but they're not frogs, go out and assemble the kings of the earth. And at this point, these human beings, what is there assembled, are not human. They are Nephilim, in my opinion. They have been genetically altered in some fashion. And they are looking up. See, most people believe that the Battle of Armageddon is between all these armies. It's not what we're looking at. It's not that at all. It's the classic battle between the fall. It goes back into the whole cosmic war that we talk about between these fallen angelic hosts and the good guys.
Hold on, Lynn. We're coming back for more. I want to get into Revelation with you in End Times on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're looking for you to sound off. Simply send your sound off to editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Simple as that. Make it about a minute long. Put your name, obviously, and phone number in there. We'll get back to you. We might record you. editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with L.A. Marzulli, and I'll be right back with him on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. L.A. Marzulli with us. And, L.A., before we get into End Times and Revelation, last week I had an opportunity to talk about Stonehenge, and that's an amazing structure too, isn't it? And what does it all mean?
Well, one of the discoveries that I sort of made, and I was watching a television program when I saw this, and I just completely was blown away by it, America on Earth. And they talked about this place called America Stonehenge in New Hampshire. And what I saw there was incredible. And, of course, I contacted these people myself and opened up a dialogue. And they sat down and we did an interview with them, written interview. And there's a man by the name of Kelsey Stone. And he's a college student. He's 22 years old. And the Stone family, no pun intended, has been curators over what they have termed, what they call America's Stonehenge. They've done testing on the site, and it's about 4,000 years old. There's also evidence of human sacrifice done there, very large, 6x9, large stone slab, like an altar, was found in this henge. Of course, a henge is a circle, and like Stonehenge, this is when you stand in the center of that circle, there are standing stones, and these standing stones go all the way around the circle. Of course, one of the standing stones would be the summer solstice standing stone, where you're standing in the center of the henge, looking out towards that standing stone, you would see the sunrise of the longest day of the year. The summer solstice sunrise would come up over that standing hole. Consequently, if you turn to the other side, you would see a standing stone where the shortest day of the year, where the sun would come up in the winter solstice. And then, of course, the equinoxes and other points. So Kelsey Stone is a college student with a very curious mind. He was kind enough and generous enough to give us the maps that he did on Google Earth, and we reprinted them in the book On the Trail of the Nephilim. And this is what absolutely blew me out of the water, George. It was just one of those finds that are absolutely astounding and make no sense at all. Kelsey Stone sitting on Google Earth, and he Googles up America Stonehenge, which is in New Hampshire. And he draws a line on Google Earth from the center of his henge in New Hampshire out to the summer solstice standing stone. Just out of curiosity, he extends the line to see where it goes. And he keeps extending it and extending it and extends it further. Now he's out a few hundred miles, and he just keeps extending the line and keeps going. And thousands of miles away, he winds up intersecting the center trilithon in Stonehenge, England. And there is absolutely no way in antiquity that you can do that. There's no way. I talked to a surveyor out here in Malibu. I said, he actually recreated the same experiment, and he just was dumbfounded. He said, that's impossible. That's very deliberate. And that means the only way to do that is from the air. And it goes back to our two paradigms. We're looking either at ET, or are we looking at evidence of the supernatural? And, of course, I believe we're looking at evidence of the supernatural. But wait, George, it gets better. Kelsey didn't stop extending a line at Stonehenge. And intersecting the center trilithon, do you realize if you're like just an eighth or a hundredth of a degree off, you'd be, you know, hundreds of miles away from Stonehenge, England. And yet it intersects perfectly, the center trilithon and Stonehenge, mind-boggling. So he takes, and there's no way to do that in antiquity. You've got to be in the air and triangle. There's just no way to do it. So he extends the line further, and he winds up in Beirut, Lebanon. Well, what's special about Beirut, Lebanon? Well, that's very close to Mount Hermon. And Beirut, Lebanon is the home of the Phoenicians, who were seafaring people.
Right. It's also near Baalbek, right? It's
also near Baalbek, and the Phoenicians were the direct descendants, get this, of the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were a Nephilim tribe. And it's just, once again, the evidence points to the fact that there was a diaspora, that there was diffusion, that these entities known as the Nephilim spread out over the earth. And with that, they bought their knowledge of megalithic structures and were able to recreate some of these structures not only throughout the Middle East, but also here in the Americas. And that just blew me away when we discovered that.
Do you think the influence of the Nephilim might be beyond just this planet?
That's a really good question. And that's always open for debate. It gets into the idea of plurality of worlds. This is where I stand with all this stuff. If we're really intellectually honest, we have no idea where we are. We're floating on this little blue ball someplace in the middle of who knows where. No idea really how we got here. We can believe the ET mythos. We can believe the biblical creation stories. They're both a matter of faith at this point because no one really knows. So what's interesting is that some physicists, and we've actually interviewed some of these people. They would not come on the record because of our connection with the UFO phenomena in the Watchers series. But
Yeah. What
if we're in a digital simulation? What if there is error-correcting software in the very fabric of the universe, as some physicists believe they've discovered, which shouldn't be there? How can you have error-correcting software in the very fabric of the universe? And I don't pretend to understand how that works for a minute. But we interviewed this guy on a telephone conversation, and it was just incredible. Chuck Missler also talks about the idea that this whole thing could in some way be some sort of holographic deal. All I know, and this is why I'm not a big fan of the plurality of the worlds deal, whatever these entities are that flit in and out, these ships that we see, these UFOs that we see, they seem very concerned with genetic manipulation on some point. They also seem very concerned with telling us who God is. So I've written about this before. Why come millions of miles to tell us this stuff? Why not just give us the cure to cancer? Why not, you know, why are you so concerned about telling
just
us
make
who
it
God
easy
is?
For us.
Yeah. But give us something
not.
Useful.
They're not making it easy for us. Why not?
Good question, George. I don't have the answer to that. I just don't trust these guys. I think they're highly malevolent, and I defer again to Jacques Vallée, Messengers of Deception, even Whitley Strieber, who talks about in the early days that these were like the demons of old. He was terrified of them, and I think he nailed it in the early days. These were malevolent entities, malevolent beings who wished him harm. And frankly, with all due respect, I think we're looking a little bit at the Stockholm syndrome here, where one begins to identify with his captors.
I think so, too. Let's talk about the revelation again, L.A., and the Antichrist. Is that individual here on the planet now?
I believe he certainly could be. I think we're in the window of time. And, you know, George, what's interesting, all this is going to play out at some point. And there's a lot of skeptics out there, and they you know, nothing wrong with being a healthy skeptic. But at some point, this stuff is going to play out, and we're going to see what the end game really is. We're going to see what mythos or what paradigm is actually reality. I believe that we're headed towards some sort of a war in the Middle East, which, by the way, was prophesied thousands of years ago. We can see what's happening with the Arab Spring, and it's the place is a tinderbox. I wouldn't go over there if you paid me right now, because war could happen at any moment, and it's going to be a nasty little war when it happens, probably World War III.
Look what's happening to Turkey right now.
There you go. Who would imagine a couple of years ago that the Arab Spring would completely turn the Middle East upside down, and that's where we are.
Yeah,
but if a nuke is used, and I've written about this extensively, we're all wired together. We've talked about that, the whole idea of this worldwide grid now back in place. We see everything in real time. When the Fukushima reactor goes down and the earthquake and the tidal flood come in, and we're watching that tidal wave in real time. We're watching it. The helicopter's filming it, bouncing off the satellite. Yeah, there's a delay, but we're watching a tidal wave come in real time. That's unprecedented. Can you imagine if war breaks out in the Middle East and some sort of a nuclear device is used? It's not like Hiroshima or Nagasaki anymore. We're all wired together. We're going to see this stuff in real time. The entire world will be plunged into the greatest collective fear that humankind has ever known. And I've stated this a priori in my books. I believe when that happens, that's when they show up, when we're at the greatest sort of a nadir on the planet, the greatest collective fear ever experienced by humankind. And that's when E.T. shows up as our saviors. And they will say, we created you, we genetically manipulated you, we started the world's religions, started the world's civilizations. Now at this critical juncture in human history, we are back to usher mankind into a time of peace and prosperity. And, oh, by the way, we've got some free gifts for you. One is free energy, the stuff that pilots the craft. No more oil dependency. We've got anti-gravity stuff. Isn't this great? Oh, the second thing, because we created you, we've got a DNA upgrade for you. You take this little chip, it'll correct your DNA. You'll live 500 years, which ties back into the biblical prophecy as the days of Noah, because one of the differentiations of the days of Noah was the length of human life. The lifespan was 500 to 900 years. So I think all this is going to happen. When that happens, just remember the show. You heard it here first on Coast to Coast with George Norrie. because that's what I think is going to happen. As crazy as it might sound, I think, and the certainly the guys like Stephen Greer and Stephen Bassett, mm-hmm. all calling for disclosure. When this happens, it's a game changer. It's a mega lever. It's a total paradigm shift. Unless you know what you're looking at. Look, one of the prophecies from the ancient biblical text talks about even the elect would be deceived, men fainting from fear from what is coming on the earth. The fallen one comes with all signs and lying wonders. We are warned very specifically that in the latter days, something will come which will cause what I term a great deception. I think we're on the verge of seeing it.
Will we believe it when it comes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People... Stephen Greer, at the end of one of the Ancient Aliens series, I think it's season three, he looks at the camera, he's doing his closing piece, and he's got this just Cheshire cat grin, and he goes, yeah, when they show up, it's going to collapse all the world's religions. You know what? He's right. Because prophecy tells us that there'll be a great falling away. And the Greek word here is apostasia, which means apostasy, which begs the question, what would cause a great falling away? Cause people to change, just walk away from a belief system and embrace another belief system. And there's only one that I'm aware of, and it's the whole ET, so-called ET phenomena, which, of course, I don't believe is ET. I believe it's the fallen angelic host posing as such, because that's what they're able to do. I call it the coming great deception, and I think it's coming.
Well, now in terms of time, when could that be?
Well, I'm not a date setter, and you know that, and I have no idea. I just see with the UFO flaps burgeoning like they are, a thousand, I think, last month George Filer was telling us, which from my study, like you, I've been following this for decades, and that's unprecedented. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, what is it going to take before the thing is revealed? And I think the reason for the cat and mouse game are twofold. One, they're waiting to perfect the chip, this implant that we see. I think a lot of these implants that people have, and by the way, we're actually in communication with several people who have these and who have been abducted since they were 5 years old. I think these are prototypes. I don't think they have it down yet. They might be trying to rush it through. However, then you get Dr. David Jacobs, who tells us that from his perspective, the breeding program has reached a conclusion that the hybrid beings look and can pass as human. They may have superhuman powers like telepathy. They may be able to move objects. I mean, who knows what they're able to do? But he believes that they're actually being integrated in the society. So it's a very extremely complex phenomenon. There's no doubt about it. But what bothers me about it, if it was benevolent, George, don't you think they would have tipped their hand? Don't you think that instead
yes.
of taking people over and over and over again, and these people are terrified, you know, sit down and talk to an abductee, that one particular gentleman we was speaking to, and he's come clean and told us that since he was 5 years old, he's been abducted. Frequent flyer. They take him over and over and over again. He's got a chip. We've seen it. We've seen the implant in his leg. It's there. Got it on X-ray. I mean, Dr. Lear looked at the thing. It's there. We know it's real. We know the phenomena is real. And I wouldn't use the word terrified, but he's not a happy camper. He doesn't want this to happen to him.
Of course
so why,
not.
Why do they do this over and over and over again? You take a five-year-old. I mean, that's innocence that everyone knows what a five-year-old is. There's just an innocence there. Taking this kid and performing sexual experimentation on him, at a five-year-old?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just plain
that's
evil.
Plain it is evil. I would agree with you. You know, I have long since said to L.A. that I think there's something else to this. This is not a friendly little takeover.
It's not a friendly deal. No way.
No, not at all. At all. Let's talk a little bit more about your work, of course, on the Trail of the Nephilim. Was it difficult for you to put this together, or was it easy?
Once we went to Peru, the book literally just everything... It's like all the pieces of the dominoes just fell over. The picture became very clear. When we had that sort of cosmic download in Cusco, all of a sudden the idea that these ancient megalithic structures like we saw in Sacsayhuaman and Ollantaytambo and in Cusco, again, George, whoever's doing this is putting these megalithic stones together, polygonal cuts, just like they were, like somehow they were lifted and just shaped and put into place, and they could do it. It was easy for them to do. You have to bring an archaeologist, all the Inca made them, baloney, the Inca made them. It's obvious when you look at the stone structures, you can see the ancient megalithic work, which is perfect, which is unbelievable in its construct. And then above that, I call it, with all due respect, Inca slop. It's more of the stones are put together. They have no idea how these ancient builders built this stuff. And above that, of course, is the Spaniard. There are three different builders, and it's obvious. We show that actually in the book and also in Watcher 6. But it's obvious that some technology was being used. And when we went to Peru, for me, it was sort of the missing piece of the puzzle that I needed, because handling the skulls in Paracas, looking at the ancient megalithic structures, seeing all this sort of just put all the pieces together, and we just went, oh my gosh, the Nephilim were everywhere, and they created these ancient megalithic structures as part of a worldwide grid. Look, other people have talked about this grid before, but no one has linked it to the days of Noah, and no one has linked it to modernity. And that's what's chilling about it, that this ancient grid system, different, is back again with the World Wide Web and the plethora of satellites that cover the globe, which will eventually, it's not being used now, but eventually, and I'm not being a prophet here because it's already in the book of Revelation, it will be used to enslave the human race. And that's just dreadful.
Sooner than later.
Sooner than later, yes.
Well, it is dreadful. It will not be a happy day or moment.
No, it will not be, George.
When all that happens, to be sure. Why planet Earth? Why here?
Well, once again, it all has to do with mankind. For whatever reason, we're of great value to the one who created us, so much so that if you believe in the Christian mythos, which, of course, to me, it's not mythos, I believe in it, you've got this God-man who incarnates on the planet 2,000 years ago, and what he does is absolutely astounding. Water to wine, walking on water, healing the sick. Wherever he goes, all we see is benevolence. And I'm not talking religion. I want to make that really clear. I'm not talking the stuff that people think is what I'm talking about. It's not religion. Everywhere he goes, all we see is good, good, good happen. People are healed. People are raised from the dead. People born blind from birth. See, we have account after account after account of this. And what's interesting, it's even happening today in places like China. The same type of quote-unquote supernatural miraculous events are happening. People are getting healed of things that they shouldn't be getting healed of. So something, this incarnation changed everything. Literally, it changed everything. And all the prophecies talk about the first coming, but they also talk about the second coming. And again, it's like religion has sort of taken this and obfuscated it with cathedrals and monks with funny haircuts and stained glass windows and rosary beads and all this other crazy stuff, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about. This is like a real experience. And the early church, let's say 2,000 years ago, before there were buildings and all this other stuff, had that experience. And that's what happened to me literally 33 years ago, and which was absolutely life-changing. And I had no idea what I was getting into when it happened, but it happened. And it's changed my life completely. It's also set me on the trail of the Nephilim, which I've been on for 25 years. And now I feel that we've kind of come full circle and have a much clearer picture of just how worldwide this was, how devastating it was, how the flood played a part in it, how the grid system in antiquity is now restored again, let's say.
Well, you are hot on it, Linda. Let me tell you, we're going to come back and take calls with you next. And, of course, this is the hour, the interactive portion of the show. We'll take your phone calls with L.A. Marzulli when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, L.A. Marzulli with us, and, of course, your phone calls. Well, I got to tell you, L.A., the future seems very fascinating, doesn't it?
It certainly does. We're in for quite a ride, George.
Just got to hold on so you don't fall off.
Absolutely.
Let's go to some calls for you in just a moment. Now, what's your next project? You never stop.
Well, we're actually working on Watcher 7, which will be UFO, the physical evidence. We're going into the lab with Stephen Colburn and Dr. Roger Lear. We're tracing the one particular gentleman who I mentioned a little bit earlier, been abducted since he was 5 years old. He now has an implant. The next step with him will be to do a CAT scan, And then, of course, from there, eventually we'll be in an operating theater and removing the implant from him and doing analysis. We also have some artifacts. We'll be flying to Mexico to meet with Jaime Musan, who I know that you know very well, and we'll be examining a orb, which apparently he has. Steve Colburn, the scientist that works with Dr. Roger Lear, and he's been working with us, will be in the lab. Steve has some a small sample that came from that orb, which crashed in a field, and when it crashed, it killed a cow. So we'll be examining all this under a scanning electron microscope. There's also a four-fingered handprint on a piece of drywall from an abduction, which we have. We'll be examining that. There's also a liquid that was found on the carpet during the same abduction. We'll be examining that. We'll also be continuing the DNA testing on the red hair, the reddish hair that we got from Paracas, from that 2,000-plus-year-old mummy. We're also going down to Peru. I can't tell you when, but soon we'll be down there again. We're actually bringing another archaeologist. We'll have two archaeologists, plus Joe Taylor will return to cast more of these skulls. And this, of course, will be volume two. I hope to go out to Catalina. I've been trying desperately to look at the journal that Glidden left, which was only discovered last year. So I'm still on the trail. There's so much to talk about, so much more evidence. I think in some ways we just sort of scratched the surface on this. And between the watchers and the research for On the Trail Volume 2, I'm a very busy man.
All right, to the phones we go. East of the Rockies, Jimmy is with us, truck driving somewhere in Ohio. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey, good morning.
Morning to you.
Listen, I wanted to ask you a question. I'm a born-again Christian, but I know for a fact that there was life before Adam and Eve. And I can prove that in the Bible, in Jeremiah, the third chapter of Jeremiah. It talks about cities that were flattened and birds that had fled away, and there was no man on the face of this earth. Now, since the day of Adam and Eve until this minute right here, there has never been a time when there was no man on the face of this earth. So the cities that were flattened had to be prior to Adam and Eve.
What do you think of that, L.A.?
Well, I've heard this before. Doesn't catch me by surprise. It certainly is interesting. It's called the pre-Adamic Earth. It certainly, this gets back into the work of David Flynn and others. Certainly Pember. I mean, I could list a whole bunch of authors which I've read which talk about the pre-Adamic Earth. It certainly is food for thought. Again, it goes back into the idea of a cosmic chess match, that there, this whole idea of fallen angelic hosts battling with the good guys, this war has been going on. There's protocols in this war which we don't understand. We don't understand why it just can't be over, but it's not over, and it's reaching a climax. What happened in antiquity, let's say thousands of years ago, is interesting, and of course is cause for great speculation when we look at the remains of dinosaurs and how does all that work. Creationists will point to the footprints next to the dinosaurs, and they say, well, see, man's walking with dinosaurs. Well, it might not be man that's walking there. What we may be looking at is angelic hosts. See, we don't really know. So why it's interesting, we can speculate and talk about that. What is interesting to me is what we discovered in Peru, what's here in the Americas, the fact that there was an ancient megalithic structures all over the earth which created a grid system. And just like prophecy tells us, as in the days of Noah, those days are back. The grid is back. It's here. It's operating. And just like the days of Noah, it will be used to enslave the entire human race.
Once they enslave the race, what are they going to do with us?
It's a real good question. And the idea is control. And you say, well, that sounds far out. But, George, we're already looking at it. Look at what the NSA is doing and PRISM and all this other nonsense. Why do these people need to do this? What it's all about control. Everything is about control. And there's some sick, twisted people out there that want control. I mean, this is what it's about. The bottom line is this angelic host, and this might sound crazy, they want to be worshipped. We see this all through antiquity, the idea of human sacrifice, which we talked about in hour one, I think. All that is a form of ritualistic satanic worship. We see it with the Nazis, the whole Holocaust. The word Holocaust means, when you translate it from the German, an offering, a burnt offering on an altar. That's what it means. And this is all ritualistic human blood sacrifice, which we really didn't get into tonight because it's a very grisly subject, very dark subject to get into. But nonetheless, it's real, and these entities want to be worshipped that way. And all we need to do is go back and look what the Mayans did. 50,000 people ritualistically slaughtered at Chichen Itza. That's very deliberate, very deliberate.
Yeah. And sick.
And sick, very sick. And evil.
Michael in Placerville, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Michael, hi.
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us.
I believe the guest is right on, nail hit on the head and countersunk with this one. I wanted to ask a question. If you know this, okay, and I don't even know if you read the scriptures, but in the book of Matthew, it talks about 10 virgins. 5 are wise and 5 are foolish, right? Well, the 5 wise ones took extra oil with their lamps. The 5 foolish ones didn't take any oil. Okay, they asked the wise ones if they can have some oil, and the wise ones tell them, no, you can't have ours. Go to them that buy and sell. I want to ask you, what does the oil, if you know, represent in this story, this parable?
Boy, I don't know. Lynn, do you?
Yeah, it's basically the oil is, in my opinion, the Holy Spirit, which, you know, when you say this, when we bandy these words around the Holy Spirit, there's something that's profound, and I've experienced this, when the Spirit of a living God, and let's just equate it to the other side of the aisle. Channelers, right, are picking up a spirit, aren't they? They're
right.
Channeling a spirit. So we know that the spirit realm is real. Well, what if God has a spirit? What if that spirit, in the same way a channeler gets a spirit, and I'm not saying channeling is a good thing. Please don't misunderstand me. We're actually told in the guidebook of the supernatural not to mess with this because the entities that we're channeling may be highly malevolent. But God's spirit is different. And when a person has that spirit in them, which happened to me 33 years ago, everything changes. So you could say in some ways I'm a channeler. And I'm sure I'm going to get all sorts of flack for that. But being so-called born again, in essence, a person becomes like a channeler because that spirit is in us, and that spirit, as Scripture tells us, will lead us and teach us in all things. That doesn't mean we're perfect. That just means if we're listening, we're going to get told stuff. And some of the stuff that, for instance, that cosmic download that we got in Cusco, George, that wasn't the hand of man that did that. That wasn't Richard and I looking at each other and sitting down and pondering all these things. It was a cosmic download. So in some, you know, the other side of the aisle would go, you know, the Arcturians told me this or whatever. Well, we believe it was the Spirit of a living God who gave that to us. That's what we believe. And is that channeling? Well, in some sort of a, I'm being humorous here, trying to be lighthearted. But in some ways, yeah, it is. I mean, we got a message, and we're telling people that this is what we got. And it's in Watcher 6, and it's in the new book. So,
how do you think they discovered this planet? I guess with technology, they spotted us, like Kepler's finding other planets now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decided, let's go there. Let's do what we do. They probably
I think they were... whatever this angelic, fallen angelic host is, they're very much aware of what's going on. They're not dummies. They're not. They're highly intelligent beings. All we need to do is look at the remains that we see in Cusco or Sacsayhuaman, where these ancient megalithic stones weighing over 120 tons are taken from 40 or 50 miles away. George, there's no way to do that. There's no way to do that. You know, did they levitate the stones? How did they cut the stones? Why do the stones fit together? I mean, you look at this thing, and it's just absolutely mind-boggling.
And it's all over the planet.
All over the place.
We'll go to Paul, truck driving in Texas now. Hey, Paul, go ahead. Take it away.
Oh, it's Carl.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Paul.
It's Carl driving in Texas.
Oh, George. Carl? Carl or Paul?
Hey, Carl.
Carl.
All right.
Hey, I really enjoy every time you're on here. I just get a blessing from it. You know, when I was, I've been, my dad was a Baptist minister, and I've been brought up in the religious field of it, I guess you'd say. And you know, I realize, you know, you're trying to stay kind of away from that because people tend to get away from it. But, you know, I think why they are so dead set on destroying the human race and trying to enslave us is because we have a connection to that higher spirit, that God connection. And they are jealous of it. They are so jealous of it, they can't stand it because they're separated away from it. Even, you know, the Jewish people, by keeping the law, had a connection to God. Then when Christ came along, we were able to have a better connection to God, a freer connection to God through grace. And they're jealous of it. That's where their whole emphasis lies, is the jealousy of it all.
Well, we know the fallen angels were jealous, L.A.
You know, absolutely. And the end game, again, we get this from the book of Revelation. We get this from prophecy that the Antichrist will seat himself in the rebuilt temple of Jerusalem. Now, that is called out with such great specificity that you can't argue with that. That means that there's going to be a temple that's going to be rebuilt in the city of Jerusalem. It's got to happen at some point. And this figure, this evil figure called the Antichrist, will seat himself in that temple and want to be worshipped. That's the end game. We see it all through antiquity. We see it with the Mayan culture, which we talked about just a few minutes ago. 50,000 people ritualistically slaughtered. We see it in these ancient megalithic sites all over the Americas. The same deal. And by the way, these ancient megalithic sites are only really viewed best from the air. You can't, when you're in the ground in the Circle Mount in Ohio, yeah, you can see it. But when you're above it in a helicopter, oh my gosh, the complex makes so much more sense. You can see it from the air. Again, the America Stonehenge that we see in New Hampshire, drawing that line from the center of the henge out to the summer standing stone, where the sun comes up over the solstice, extending that line, and it intersects the Trellisan in Stonehenge, England, thousands of miles away. That is deliberate. You can only do it from the air. And we know from the guidebook of the supernatural that the prince of the power of the air is none other than the fallen one himself.
Joshua is in Phoenix, Arizona, first-time caller. Josh, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, LA.
Josh. I love your show. I'm going to keep it short. Basically, what I wanted to say is I believe everything you guys are saying, and I've been studying it for a while. What I think, this is a theory of mine, is that the United States is setting up position in the Middle East for when the angels, the fallen angels, do come down, the good ones, the benevolent ones, they're going to be there to fight against them. And I believe that's why we're here in the Middle East right now.
Will there be good ones, L.A., or are they all very bad?
Well, no, let's hope the good ones make an appearance. Richard, my business partner and co-producer of the Watcher series, we talk about this endlessly. We know that the fallen ones are manifesting like crazy. We are, and as other people, too, that I've spoken to at the conferences I attend and all this other stuff, we're waiting. We believe that at some point in time, some of the good guys may show up, and that's what we're hoping for. They showed up in the guidebook of the supernatural, i.e. the Bible, all the way through it, so why not now? But right now, we're not getting a lot. I mean, we're not. It seems like this is the time of the fallen one to fully manifest, and that's what he's doing.
Okay, let's go next. Josh, thanks, by the way. Steve is a Skype caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, George, how you doing, man?
Good, good. You're coming in loud and clear.
Good. Happy belated birthday. You got to love Skype.
Bye.
That's yeah, my comment was, you know, there seems to be an awful lot of evidence for the Nephilim, and it seems like the academics and the governments are covering it up for some reason. What does your guest think the reason might be they might be covering it up?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for asking that. We sort of touched on that a little bit about the first hour. It's very simple. The Darwinian paradigm permeates, is sacrosanct in both academia and the scientific community. The Darwinian paradigm states that all this just evolved. There is no supernatural. There is no God. This whole thing just happened, and here we are. Anything that bumps up against that Darwinian paradigm is immediately dealt with. And what we've discovered is that you know what? We've got evidence that proves that something else was here that doesn't jibe with the Beringian land bridge at the end of the last ice age, that these cultures had technology, which makes no sense to us at all. For instance, what we see in Sacsayhuaman and Ollantaytambo, and also the Great Circle Mound in Ohio. And this, of course, goes against the Darwinian paradigm and points back to, this is the whole point of the Washer series, the whole point of everything that we do. It points back to what is in the guidebook of the supernatural, i.e. the Bible, and says that, oh my gosh, here's real physical evidence that what was talked about in these ancient scriptures is true. It's true. It's not the work of Zechariah Sitchin, which, you know, there's no prophecy there, with all due respect. I mean, this stuff is thousands of years old. The prophecies are coming true. And everything that was said, we're starting to get physical evidence. That points to the supernatural. And you can't have the supernatural in a Darwinian paradigm. So they are at loggerheads against each other. What are we taught in schools? We're taught the Darwinian paradigm. It is everywhere, absolutely everywhere. If you want to be in academia and you don't hold to the Darwinian paradigm, good luck. Won't work. And that's what we're really looking at here. That's why this book and the Watchers DVD, frankly, is so dangerous, because it blows the lid, the fact that, there's been a deliberate cover-up of this stuff. Why can't we see these artifacts? Why can't we see these giant skeletons? And you know what one of the archaeologists told me, who's a tenured professor at a university, I won't mention her name because she's on the other side of the aisle, so to speak. She told me that men and women back in the 1920s who were measuring articulated or disarticulated skeletons between 9 and 11 feet, get this now, hold your breath, drum roll please, did not know how to measure.
What do you mean they didn't know how to measure?
That's what she said. So, in other words, their measurements of 9-foot, 10-foot, 11-foot skeletons were wrong because they didn't know how to measure. You want to talk about fundamentalism? I mean, that is like walking around with blinders on. Because if there's a 9-foot skeleton, George, it goes against the Darwinian paradigm. It
yes.
blows it right up. Darwinism doesn't work.
They can't handle that. L.A., stay with us. We're going to come back with you in just a moment. We're talking about his book, On the Trail of the Nephilim. So up next, of course, we will take some final phone calls. Those of you from all around the globe, just stay where you are. We'll get right back to you right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Father Sebastian joins me. We're going to talk about vampires. He likes them, so make sure you're part of that show. When we come back with L.A. Marzulli, final phone calls as we talk about On the Trail of the Nephilim. And welcome back, L.A. Marzulli with us. Lynn, somewhere along the line, years ago, this fascinated you, and you got into it, obviously, in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? What was that point?
Well, I, for me, it was the book that I read by Dr. I.D.E. Thomas, and that goes back into the late 80s. I had always been interested in the whole UFO phenomenon and very much interested in prophecy. What put it together was when I read Dr. Thomas's his work called The Omega Conspiracy. He's now 93 years old and in very declining health. But that book was just an absolute mind blower because it talked about the Nephilim. And I'd read about the Nephilim, but I'd never understood it and really had no idea of really what or who they were. And this book, The Omega Conspiracy, it's just a must read. It's absolutely a must read. And he also quoted from the Book of Enoch, which I had never even heard of also. And reading the Book of Enoch right after Dr. I.D.E. Thomas's Omega Conspiracy was just like, it just lit up the darkness. And I went, oh my gosh. And that was it. I mean, I've never looked back. And that's going on over 25 years now.
That is phenomenal. To west of the Rockies we go, John, Salt Lake City. Go ahead, John.
Yes, thank you, George. I must say I've been listening to your show for quite a few years, and this has got to be the most exciting guest I've had a chance to talk to. I know he's talking about his new book on the Trail of the Nephilim, but I had a question asked your guest. Dealing with on his Watchers 5, he goes – I didn't hear this, but I used to work at Stanford University, and one time I walked into the reference library just trying to kill some time, and I picked up this book. And it started going about Admiral Byrd and the hollow earth theory. And I remember I put it down and then never able to find that again. And I was told by a friend who subscribes to Prophecy Magazine that your guest talks about that. I'm just wondering, I don't want to get off track here, but since he was the guess, involved. If you can maybe go a little bit into that about the Hollow Earth theory, and I'll take my message off the air. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, you're welcome. Was that you, Lynn?
Well, I've talked about it. We've never really done a major segment. The man I've spoken to about it was Jim Williamson, who's written a book called Beyond Science Fiction, which talks about the whole UFO phenomena, but also talks about the Hollow Earth theory. I've touched on it. I do believe in it. But there's even more than that is when the guidebook talks about this abyss, this pit opening up, and these entities. That could be like an interdimensional portal, which may in some way come out of the Earth, but it may also be some sort of an interdimensional portal which allows these entities to come through. Admiral Byrd, certainly, I've followed that, looked at the diary entries, that whole thing, found it very fascinating. The Piri Reis map, very fascinating stuff. There's a lot we don't know, and certainly the Hollow Earth theory is one of those which just always keeps me thinking.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Mike, Kings Mountain, North Carolina. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, I am so glad, so honored to get to talk to Mr. Marzulli. I've been watching you on some excerpts on the prophecy in the news, and I have several things I'm going to try to get in 25 words or less here. that giant skeleton, I looked like a Bedouin was kneeling beside it like a grave. Was that a superimposed picture, or was that an actual picture?
I have to look at it. There's a lot of hoaxes out there. There's a lot of stuff that's photoshopped. The picture
looked like it was about 20 foot long.
Yeah.
But anyway, I read in the book of Amos, I believe it's the second chapter, when they were talking about the height of some of these Rephaim. They said its height was as of the cedars.
Yes.
And cedar trees can be anywhere from like 12 to 18 feet. And I noticed that. And then I guess the last thing I'll ask in passing is this the whole idea, the conception of the angels being able to mingle themselves with the planet. I thought only – I am a Christian, by the way, and I believe Christ. But I find it hard to believe that God would allow these angels to do this procedure with the – human genome.
Well, and that has been the great conundrum where many people refuse to look at that. Yet the text is extremely clear. The other ancient texts, let's say the Jewish historian from the first century, Josephus, writes about the bones of the Nephilim were openly on display at the time of the writing, which is the first century. That's almost 2,000 years ago. The bones of the Nephilim were openly on display so that the Israelites could look at what their ancestors took out of the land. And these giant skeletons, easily 15, 16 feet, perhaps taller. We know that Og of Bashan was at least 15 feet. Goliath was a Nephilim. They're everywhere. This stuff is everywhere. And when we went to South America, we went to Peru. If you're on the website, go to Coast to Coast website and look at the skulls yourself. And I've had three doctors, medical doctors, look at these things, and they all three concur, including Dr. Roger Lear, that these skulls are anomalous. It's too early to say exactly what they are. The theory is that these are Nephilim skulls. That's the theory. And so far, everything's holding up. An anthropologist called me tonight and weighed in on the Judd Burton, in fact, who was in Peru. He's finished his research, and he believes that four of the skulls that we saw in Paracas definitely do not appear human. There's something else going on with them. So, you know, we're on the trail. What can I say?
How much does DNA cost these days for something like that?
I've heard a different – when we got back, I actually took some of the hair and had it tested at this one lab. It was $250, but it was the wrong lab. They weren't able to extract DNA because they don't do DNA testing of ancient artifacts. So we're actually we've got more of the hair left. I know that Brian Forrester has contacted Melba Ketchum, and he's trying to get DNA testing. So far, he's got no results. I was just contacted literally in the last 48 hours. How serendipitous is that? By a millionaire, apparently, who wants to do testing on the skulls in Peru. So we've got the hair, and we're trying to get that set up. He'll foot the bill, and we'll see what happens. And that's what that just happened in the last 48 hours. Literally.
Oh, that's exciting. All right, let us know about that. Catherine in Holbrook, Arizona, wild card line. You're up with L.A. Marzulli. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, George. Happy belated birthday.
Well, thank
Happy
you.
Birthday, George.
Thanks, L.A.
Mine was the 28th of May. Mr. Marzulli, my question for you is, if I understand, the mark of the beast has to be given willingly, but these people are being forced to take these implants. Now, could it be that their ancestor family made a deal with the Nephilim? And by the way, thank God somebody's got some sense to figure out what the UFOs are. But anyway, could their families have made a deal saying that, you know, if you'll give us power, we'll give you our ancestors? Understand what I'm saying?
No, I do. I understand exactly what you're saying. Look, these chips, these implants that people have are prototypes. This is what I firmly believe. They're not the end game yet. They're not the finished deal. The implants differ. The implants that Dr. Lear took out, let's say a decade ago, are much different than what they are now. The first implants he took out crumbled in like 4 to 6 pieces. The 16th one he took out was not, you couldn't scratch it, couldn't cut it with a diamond blade saw, had to be taken to a laboratory and cut in half with a laser beam. So these things, there's an evolution to these things. I think they're prototypes. I don't think they're set up, quote, as the mark yet, but I firmly believe that this is it. I firmly believe that this is it.
Would you ever get that mark, Lynn, if they forced you?
No way.
Nope. Me either.
Nope.
Let's go to John, Bronx, New York. Hi, John. Thanks for holding.
Hi,
go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good.
I wanted to ask your guest. He mentioned earlier about the fallen angel hosts, who he believes these ETR actually are. Now, you mentioned that they're trying to instill or teach about a concept or idea of God. Doesn't this run counterproductive to their intentions, to their true intentions for being here?
State that again. I didn't catch that whole thing. One more thing.
Yes. You mentioned that these ETs, which you believe are the fallen angel hosts, mm-hmm. Are instilling concepts or ideas of God in their abductees.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, doesn't this run counter to their intentions here on Earth?
Not at all. What they're setting up, for instance, with all due respect to every Billy Meyer, when we look at what this entity called Semyaza, which, by the way, is also referred to in the Book of Enoch thousands of years ago, is it the same interdimensional entity that is now in contact with every Billy Meyer? We don't know. But I find it fascinating that Semyaza is found in the Book of Enoch as the lead rebel angel that comes to Earth and procreates and creates the Nephilim. And all of a sudden, thousands of years later, literally thousands of years later, an entity with the same name, Semyaza, and that's not exactly, you know, John or Bob, if you get my drift here, appears to every Billy Meyer and tells him who God is. You see, it's all about deception. And so they're steering us away. They've come to tell us who God really is. Well, you know, why are you so interested in that? I mean, who cares? Give us the cure to cancer. Get my drift?
But they won't, will they?
No, they won't.
And that tells you many things that you need to know just with that. Riverside, California, Walter's with us. Hey, Walter, go ahead.
Hi, George. Love the show.
Thank you, sir.
Marzulli, I think you're doing a great job helping people aware and with the Watchers series and everything.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Also, the statement that Paul from Texas said earlier, that was awesome. That was inspirational right there. But my question for you, Mr. Marzulli, is in regards to Bible prophecy, and that's what the first prophecy about the mark was and how that was given. And then also when Jesus talked about two in the field, two in the millstone, and two in bed, and then, you know, one of them's gone. What was that about? And thank you for that. I'll take my answer off the air, I think.
Okay, great. Well, you know, good questions. The second part of the question, when he's talking about one person a field, one person taken, that has to do with what some people call the rapture. And, of course, that's already gotten a bad rap. In fact, George, I was on your show when that whole debacle was coming down that the rapture was going to happen on such and such a date, and I went on your show and said, there's no way it's going to happen on such and such a date, guaranteed. Look, if we're in a supernatural world, this stuff, it might sound incredibly far out, But what's so far out about that? I mean, we hear about these things all through the ancient texts. We can read about very similar situations where people were taken and moved and translated. Look at Enoch, was taken up into heaven, supposedly. You know, I believe that literally happened. Why are we so taken aback when we read about these things? It's like if we're in a supernatural world and we see the supernatural manifesting, what's so hard about beaming up a couple of, you know, million or billion people? What's you know, I don't see anything. I don't see a big deal with that at all. And the scripture, of course, is, I tell you a mystery, we shall not all die, but some of us will be changed in a twinkling of an eye at the last trumpet, will rise in the air and meet the Lord in the air, and so ever will be with him. That's the promise, and the word rapture doesn't occur in that scripture. It's actually raptura, which is the Latin, or the word, Greek word is actually harpazo. It's a translation. I have absolutely no problem. In fact, this might sound a little woo-woo, but about 4 or 5 years ago, I had one of those experiences. I've only had a few of these, George. They don't happen often. I've had two of them where I was taken out, literally taken out of my body. In the body, out of the body, don't know. And I was there in the rapture scene for 3 seconds. Okay, I was there. I got to see it for 3 seconds. The first second was I looked around, and there was this vast assembly as far as the eye could see. We were all facing the same direction. The second I noticed that there was a holy reverential silence. No one was going, oh, my gosh, what happened? Where are we? No one was doing that. Holy reverential silence. You could hear a pin drop in that place. The third second, and this is the kind of stuff you can't make up, I realized that all the nasty stuff, what some people will call sin nature, the things that we don't do, the things that we do that we don't want to do, that was gone. That wasn't there anymore. And then I was back, and I just went, whoa, what just happened? And I collapsed on the floor and just wept because it was unbelievable to be there for 3 seconds.
Just there was. Let's take some final calls here. Jason in Greensburg, Kentucky. Hey, Jace, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hey, George, thanks for taking my call, and happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
L.A., and you to you again. I don't know if you remember, I spoke with you when you were in Stamford, Kentucky, back in March of last year.
Okay.
I just want to make a quick comment and a question about the structures that you were speaking of earlier. Right now, I'm reading a book by Connie Huff called Know Thine Enemy, and there's a chapter on these structures, and she says in here, well, I'll give it to you real quick, and you can just give me your thoughts on it. She says in here, she says that until she actually started to study the megaliths, she never thought anyone but Satan and his fallen angels and giants were behind these huge technological achievements until two scriptures were brought to my attention. The two scriptures were Jeremiah 32:20 says, God has set sight and wonders in the land of Egypt even to this day. And then the other one, Isaiah 19:19 says, in that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of Egypt and a monument at the border thereof to the Lord, and it shall be a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. So I was just going to get your thoughts on that. Apparently she seems to think, she talks about Satan being the counterfeiter to everything that God does, he wants to try to counterfeit, and I just was going to ask your thoughts on those.
Yeah, I'm great question, and thanks for calling in. I'm very familiar with that verse, and I'm also familiar with Connie's book. I have it, and we actually spoke at a conference together, which is interesting. I believe that the Giza pyramid is not that particular that verse that you quoted does not refer to the Giza pyramid. That's speculation. We don't know what that verse is really looking at. I believe that the Giza pyramid was some sort of power plant. It's not a tomb. With all due respect to Zawi Hawass, it's some sort of power plant. It helped power the grid. Again, the same piezoelectric properties that we see in the great granite blocks found in the Great Pyramid, we also find in Rock Wall, Texas. How can that possibly be? That's the work of John Lindsay, and we covered that in one of our Watchers films. But look, this grid was all over the planet. It was destroyed, we believe, during the flood. We saw the remnants of that when we were in Oyet and Tambo. What we saw there was absolutely mind-blowing. And you remember, these stones, which are fit together perfectly, when some of the stones are revealed, what joints are, and this was absolutely fascinating, George, it's highly polished stone. It's not rough stone. It's highly polished stone, and it's so smooth when these stones fit, you can't put a human hair between them. The technology that did this defies anything that I know of.
You'd be hard-pressed to do it in modernity. You might be able to do it, but it would cost millions and millions of dollars.
It really would. L.A., would you get out your website for us, please?
I'd love to. Thanks so much, George. It's www.lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net, L-A-M-A-R-Z, as in zebra, U-L-L-I, lamarzulli.net.
Super. L.A., you take care of yourself. Always a pleasure. Be safe, okay?
Thanks so much, George. Really appreciate it.
L.A. Marzulli, his book on the trail of the Nephilim. And take a look at the picture he's sent us that Lex has highlighted at coasttocoastam.com.